Hi, Evelyn.
Hi
Nice
there.
to meet you. Sorry, there was a bit of a delay there because I was trying to pull up my files. So, welcome to Mel Gabby and Friends, Bridging Psychology and Spirituality, the podcast. I just want to sort of share something of your bio about your extensive experience and time as a am I going to say it right? Shamanic practitioner?
Yes.
Okay, so Evelyn Rysdyk has once been described as a part storyteller, part minister, part scientist, and part fairy godmother. Evelyn is the author of several noted books on shamanism, including The Norse Shaman, Spirit Walking, A Course in Shamanic Power, A Spirit Walker's Guide to Shamanic Tools, The Nepalese Shamanic Path and Shamanic Creativity. So, along with her writings, Evelyn is an impassioned shamanic teacher and storyteller with over 30 years of experience of working with people who are eager to grow and experience their true power. She's been featured instructor on the Shift Network, the Sounds True, and other online teaching venues, and the founder of the Spirit Passages Academy and New Humans, New Earth Summit. Whether through face-to-face contact with individual clients, workshop groups, and online participants, or through the printed word, Evelyn uses her humor, loving humor, and passion to open people's hearts, expand their awareness, and inspire them to live a more joyful, fulfilling, and purposeful life. So, welcome, Evelyn, to the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me. This is grand.
So, we met a couple of weeks ago and had a really long chat and shared some of our ideas about the work, and I thought it'd be great to bring you on and find out more about the path and how long you've been doing it and exploring a little bit more about shamanism and the work that you do. So if you'd like to, you've got a 30-year extensive history, so if you'd just like to share, start wherever feels comfortable.
Well, what I can say is my introduction to shamanism with an instructor happened in the middle of a screeching depression. I realized when I had an acute depression that I had been dysthymic my entire life, chronic depression for the rest of the audience. And I was going to therapy twice a week. I had medication to help me sleep because it was the pre-Prozac days. I'm older than I look. And so I thought, well, let me look for some way to pull myself up by my bootstraps. So I got a great big thick catalog from a place called the Open Center. I don't even know if they're still in business anymore. And it had, 101 things that you could participate in that would improve your life, some of which were way out of my comfort zone. You'd think the shamanism would be out of my comfort zone, but there's a story in that too. So I went through all of them, and there were two that sounded interesting. One was Zen archery, become the bow, become the arrow. And the other was The Way of the Shaman with the author of the book, Michael Harner. And I had read his book about 10 years prior when it had first come out as a small paperback. I thought, well, if nothing else, it'd be entertaining. So I went into Manhattan that day and was down in Soho in a dance studio. I arrive and sign in at the front desk, and there are 150 people sitting on the floor. That was out of my comfort zone back then. So 150 people sitting on the floor. So I thought, okay, so I'll be sitting on the floor. And Michael told stories and lectured for probably half the first day. And any of you who have been depressed, you may have a different description for it, but I felt like one of those horses that pull a cart where they put those blinders or blinkers on the side so they can only see the road ahead. And that was my experience of depression. Like my world had narrowed to a tunnel. And so we finally lay down to have our journey. So now 150 people are lying down on the floor. Michael is standing in the middle, and he's going to have us do a journey to meet a power animal. The very first journey, I met a power animal, all those good things. I felt the space open up inside of me. I felt my, it's not that my depression was completely gone, but it's like the lights had been turned on, or somebody had thrown open all the shades. You know, it was just this possibility rushing back into my life. And as a concrete Taurus, it would have been nice to have a specific direction, but possibility in general was good. So that said, I don't know what this is in its fullness, but I have to do more, because this is doing more for me than medication is doing more for me than psychotherapy. And I had a wonderful therapist. It wasn't that she wasn't doing her job. And so I looked up the very next thing that they offered, which is a 5-day program to learn how to teach somebody how to journey in a counseling context, where they would learn shamanic journeying as a path of empowerment. In my wonderful head here, I said, well, if I want to know more about journeying, a class on how to teach it would give me more information. So I took this week-long training. And of course, leading up to it, right before it, I thought, you know, I'm a creative person. I'm a painter and a silversmith, and I was in advertising at the time as an illustrator. How do I know I'm not making this up? So, and not that it wasn't good, but if I might share this with somebody else, I wanted to make sure that this felt, that was real, right? Mm. I don't want to be, you know, sharing something that really wasn't true. So I went with a quest to discover my great-great-grandmother's recipe for a drawing salve to draw out infection. And it was something that I used as a child. She had 7 kids, and they didn't want to learn how to make medicine because of the time that they were alive and she was alive. So she refused to even teach her 5 daughters how to cook. Nobody was allowed in her kitchen. And I used that as a kid. I have the kind of skin, old berserker stock, I think, on the Norwegian side, where if I get a wound, it closes up immediately and starts to heal, even though it's dirty. So I would always have to use some grandma salve to let it be cleared and then start to heal. And none of the over-the-counter things did the job the same way. I said, if this is real, I want to learn how to make grandma salve. It's hidden knowledge. It's lost to time. This is supposed to transcend ordinary time space. That's what I want to do. So I went in there with this agenda. Over the course of this 5-day program, I got to meet my great-great-grandmother, apologize for that 3-generation gap between us. And I said, I would love to know how to make your salve. It's something I used when I was a little girl. It always worked in ways that over-the-counter medication didn't. Would you show me how to do that? And I'm a visual journeyer. So she actually did. She showed me how to make the salve, how to gather the ingredients as they did back then. Like, you need this much of this. You need this much of this. No cups and measures and anything like that. And the course was in summer. I dutifully wrote everything down. It's in summer. And the base for the salve is goose grease, goose fat, rendered goose fat. So it took a while to get an organic goose in summer. It's more of a Christmas thing. I finally made the salve. It smelled right. It looked right. But now does it work? I roughhouse with my cats all the time, and I'm usually lacerated here and there. So I aggravated a cat scratch until I got it really infected and tried the salve. And in the morning, just as we did when I was a child, you open it up and all the pus and whatnot would be on the bandage and the wound would be clear. And so I had a lot riding on this. So I peeled it off in the morning. And just like, you know, I don't know how many years earlier, all the goop was in the bandage and the wound was fine. It was already starting to heal again. It was all nice and pink. And I went, okay, that's it. I'm sold. I found something that I could not discover using ordinary methods. And somehow this process led me in the direction I needed to go. From that point, knock wood, I have not had any depression. And this is 30 years. I'm not even dysthymic anymore. And so that excitement of having not only a tool to discover things, and that makes my intellect and my inner child just delirious with like having research librarians at your beck and call. You know, you can find out anything. Between that and the change in my physical and mental ability, presentation, whatever you want to say, just said, this is magic, and I need to play in this playground.
Wow.
So that that desire to play in that playground has led to exploring it as deeply as I possibly can with not only Western teachers, but with Indigenous teachers. And that incredible feeling of knowing that you, no matter what's going on around you, you may have helpful people in your life, but you also have this other resource that is there 24/7. It has a perspective that the people in your life may not be able to provide. And between both of those, you have this, you know, I'm old enough to remember when they first came out with widescreen Panavision in the cinema. You know, you went from a screen that was this big, and then, and that's the feeling. It's like, now my view is not here. Mm-hmm. My view is like, with Dolby sound too. That's a long answer, but it's an answer to the question.
Well, it's fascinating that you said that you'd had depression for a long time, and then through this experience. So one, what is shamanism? And two, to explain to people who haven't heard of journeying, and what is journeying? And then what was it about that supported the depression to clear?
I will do my best with that. So shamanism is a spiritual tradition that is really goes back as far as our hunter-gatherer ancestors. And it is rooted in the need to solve problems. If you think about how far our ancestors, our deep ancestors, wandered the planet, moving from place to place, surviving an ice age, and each time they're moving, and also as climate is shifting, they have to relearn where the resources are. They have to relearn different plants that are good for medicine and food. The patterns of the animals moving around are going to change. There was one point near the end of the last ice age where climate was shifting so dramatically. Within 10 years, you'd have these shifts from forest back to tundra. So in a lifetime, and an elder would live to be about 45, you could see four different shifts that would happen of such dramatic proportions. You had to have some way to look beyond the horizon, both literally and figuratively. And we are wired for transcendence. We're wired to experience more than our five senses. And in different ways, in different cultures, there is a tool used to support you to step into that larger sense of who you are, where you can perceive more than, more than ordinary reality. In my case, I use a repetitive sound, either rattling or drumming. And that rhythm of 240 beats a minute gives you roughly, it's a pretty fast drum beat, helps your brain entrain to that rhythm. Of course, brains love to entrain to rhythm, and it opens up four different brainwave states simultaneously: alpha, delta, gamma, and one more. I'm doing this without notes.
Beta.
Yes. No, not beta. There's one more.
It's theta, beta, alpha, and gamma.
Yeah. Well,
yeah.
So that quality gives you the ability to perceive, and some people are visual, some people are auditory, some people are kinesthetic, just as they are in ordinary life, that you take those same skills with you. You are able to use your native way of being with that expanded perception, because I don't think of it as altered consciousness so much as expanded perception. We're just stepping into the larger sense of who we are, where we can contact the numinous. And that process is the journey. You go with some kind of intent, and you will meet teachers, guides, and I always have people get a power animal right away. You have this trajectory in a journey where you go in search of the teacher, you ask the teacher what your inquiry might be, and then you may have a journey within that journey as part of the explanation of the answer of what you need. And that process over time actually rewires you. Mm. So you, I'm sure you know a lot more about brain activity than I do as a therapist, but the activation of those brain wave states improves your creativity, your intuition, your imagination, your ability to synthesize divergent information. You can kind of test an idea in your head in a better way, where if you're I'm a spatial person, I can sort of turn things around in my head to figure out the best solution for the problem. And all of those capabilities that I already had, it's like they got turbo boosted. And I didn't realize that was a positive side effect until, 25 years down the line. That suddenly, as a creative, I'm way more creative. I went from being a visual artist to also being an author. And there's no end to the way that seems to work in my life. And I credit that change in my brain and in my being for that, not only the cure for depression, because I think depression is the opposite of an expanded state. It's a contracted state.
Contracted, yeah.
So that opening up was in itself part of the cure. It's like taking you out of the little box and putting you over here in this big spacious place.
Wow.
Did that answer your question?
Yeah, I'm just thinking about the sort of multi-level aspects of that. Now we know a lot more about neuropsychiatry and neurobiology and the chemistry part of it. You know, a lot of mental health, there's a lot of myths around it, and that we have mental health issues because of some imbalance in chemistry, of the chemicals in the system, which is one of the biggest myths around. And yet what you're talking about, the brain entrainment of using those four different states, or facilitating those four different states at the same time and going into that expanded state of awareness, means you're going to be either activating or creating new neural pathways to override the usual pathways that you sit in, because part of depression is a stuck cycle as well, isn't it? Is your perceptions, attitudes, beliefs, and conditioning in the human element is what can facilitate. And it is different for different people, mm-hmm. but I'm imagining that if you expand that and facilitate those states, is that you are bypassing, rerouting almost. It'd be interesting to see what happens on I don't know if anyone's done any neuroimaging in this process. You're nodding.
Well, I'm excited about what you're saying, because I think that would be brilliant to be able to see, to test people that are depressed or anxious and see how their brain changes during the journey state, and to notice if those changes become more and more permanent. It's like the more you use the wiring, the better the road is. Instead of being a rickety little back road that you keep using that pathway, it gets to be more robust and the old ones wither. So
yeah,
a very cool thing to do.
Well, there has been a lot of research looking at some of the general approaches to mental health, but it's almost like a hyper process. Like you said, it's almost like being on the fast route of some of the research has shown, say, meditation creates more gray matter, and you can, through guided visualization and, positive psychology and all of these different aspects that's coming through now, create new neural pathways. And you're right, is that the less you tend to switch into that old modality, that part of the brain will wither away, it won't be used as much. And they know that about the research. But this is almost like a hyper state of meditation, like a state that would take you much longer to get in and a much longer time to practice to get into that state. This almost facilitates that really rapidly. That's what I'm picking up from this.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Yeah. That using, you know, in some cultures they use, you know, magic mushrooms, or they use some other kind of plant like ayahuasca. I happen to like using a sound because that puts me in control of how long I want to be away from ordinary reality. It allows me to do it and not have to wait for a chemical to get out of my body to be through, so that I can implement whatever it is that I've received. So it, for myself, I find that to be a much more facile way of going and coming and being able to then implement what I receive. The benefit, the other benefit, which maybe is more less quantifiable, but the benefit of feeling as though you have more resource to bring to life.
Yeah.
You know, it again, it's a kind of soft thing. You can't really quantify that very well, but somehow you do not feel as limited, even though it's not you that you're getting the information from. It's from the spirits, that sense of, I have resources.
Yeah.
And whatever comes my way, I have another way to look at it. And, you know, you can add to this, while journeying is wonderful in and of itself, in shamanism, you also have the idea of spirit illness, which is usually a loss of some of your spiritual energy, and then an intrusion of spiritual energy that doesn't belong to you. And working with those is another way of putting things in place. You know, if something happened to us when we were 3 or 5 or whatever, we can do a lot of work going back, nurturing that child. You can do that also in a journey where you go and take care of that little one and help to make it okay. But imagine if you could basically heal that child in the journey state, bring back what she or he lost, she, he, or they lost in that experience, an aspect of themselves, a perception, something that they lost. And also remove, and I think about this for kids who are perped in sexual abuse, to remove the energy of the one that harmed them. Because though that combination, so then it's just them, full of who they are, and they not carrying any of that other energy, changes the way they look at their past as well as moving forward in their future. And we chatted a little bit before we went on air. My partner is a psychotherapist. And when we first got together, she was working with very, very damaged people that had had terrible experiences. She had a panel that was probably a third cult survivor. The rest of them were sexual abuse survivors. And several of them were also DID, dissociative identity people. So that she was heroic in her task at that point in her life. And what we did is with her, the relationship she had built with those people, they were willing to try something else. For some of them, it was to do a healing on their behalf, to have them lying on the table, doing a journey that we narrated so they knew what was going on, and to receive back the energy that had been taken from them, to remove anything that doesn't belong to them. And that sounds so simple. And to also bring them back a protector. That sounds so simple. But it made such remarkable change in people. And when people were at the level that they could journey successfully and come back to ordinary reality, they could go, but they had to remember to come back. When they were able to do that with some facility, then we taught them how to journey. So then they had counselors available to them 24/7. 365 days a year that they could go through. If they're having a speed bump at 3 o'clock in the morning, they could go be held by their power animal, talk to their teacher or guide, and get some of that settling down so that they could sleep that night. And then they might call my partner in the morning and say, well, this is what I did. And then they'd get more encouragement over the phone. So what I love is somehow this tool that they say it's somewhere between 60,000 to 100,000 years old is so effective in the 21st century for completely different reasons. But in some ways, we're paralleling the kind of difficulty, a crisis, I would probably say, that our ancestors faced at the end of the last ice age, when their entire environment was completely topsy-turvy. And we're facing that for completely different reasons. And we have to be able to be resourceful. We have to be able to find new ideas that we have never thought of. We have to find ways also to, through that way of being, where you recognize that everything is alive and is capable of being in relationship through journeying, that we have the capacity to step into a different relationship with each other as a species, and with our species being in a different relationship with the natural world. It feels so, to me, it feels like something beyond our human consciousness was calling this back at a time that we were going to need it. You know, it just feels like when you're out of ideas, that this resource that opens your vision and opens possibilities is so timely. You know, it's, to me, it's one of those things that just fills me with gratitude and a sense of wonder and just feeling like, damn, that's cool.
It is cool because there's so many things that are rushing through my head that this links with. So if we think about mental health as being on a continuum between, you know, not okay and okay, depression, stress, or any of the diagnostic language we use means that somebody has moved right over to the not okay end of their mental health and well-being. And depression and anxiety being some of the most common things that people go and see GPs about. And it's interesting because we sort of demonize depression in a way and see it as a negative experience, where in some cases, depression is exactly like what you say, where somebody's totally lost their energy for a variety of reasons. And that can be that it's years of trauma and stress, or they've just been overgiven, and they're depleted. And so their system needs to go into hibernation. They need to sleep, need to eat, and they need to get the basic needs met. But the aspect that is also fascinating with this is what you talked about, resources. And often people, if they experience depression, it's also about a loss of control, a feeling of hopelessness, a feeling of shrinking, of their world shrinking. And the more that they stay in that place, and people can get irritated with their friends and partners when they're in that really flat, neutral gray zone, let alone if they've fallen into a spiral or a pit and sank right into that place, is that they don't realize that there's some way of getting some control, or they don't know how to reconnect with that energy, or because the conditioning also that's gone on in society, and it's something I've spent a lot of time researching since the early 1900s, since we started splitting holistic ways with the scientific ways, which one could argue why it was funded and why we went down that route, of this idea that you could split mind, body, and spirit apart, and that you could somehow categorize these experiences that people were having through this way of languaging it, or this symptomology, and call it something. But so much of that was grounded in times that people didn't really have the understanding. Spirituality has also been separated from the science. So the spirit and the soul and the way that we connect with ourselves and the way that we connect with other people. And so it's like we've got that individual experience, the micro, we've got the connection with people around us, our family and community, the macro. And it's exactly that I've been seeing as well, because the clinical staff on my team, when I was running a service, we did psychosocial assessments. We looked at what was going on for the person, what were they experiencing, what didn't seem to be working, how long, but what was going on in their family and in the environment and with their work and everything else, because it's all interconnected. And at first, people just wanted us to work on the depression. The depression is the symptomology of something much bigger. And certainly since COVID and the experiences people had during that time, we've now got these layers of trauma that people have either been reconnected with, because one out of three have experienced sexual abuse, domestic violence, and probably one out of two have experienced some level of dramatic trauma, because there's trauma on all sorts of levels. So we've got this whole conditioning and way of looking at mental health and depression and anxiety through quite a distorted lens. And it's fascinating that you're talking about that we go back to the resources, because we don't help people think about what resources have they got and what aspects of themselves have they maybe shut off or cleared away or can't look at because it's too bad, it's too shameful, they're guilty, let's put it in a corner, or I'm too scared to talk about it because you might think I'm crazy. All of those facets that make it really difficult for people to experience some of those difficulties, find help, or know that actually you can on a dime sometimes really make quite a big dramatic shift, like what you describe in your experience, which clearly you were meant to go on that path. But that our whole culture is quite distorted in terms of our view and understanding of mental health and well-being.
Well, you're absolutely right. And part of it is that there's no permission to make mistakes. There's no permission to experience a failure. There's no permission for the process that you go through as you grow as an individual. Mm-hmm. That is not reflected in the culture. You're either on top or you haven't made it yet. I mean, it's certainly, I think, mm-hmm. exacerbated to a high degree here in the United States, but it's that idea that there's no space for a personal evolution to be not just acceptable, but a natural part of growth that requires perceptual shifts about who you are, where you are in life, what people you need to be around. You know, all of that can shift innumerable times in your life, but somehow there's no reflection in the culture of that's the right way. Just stay with your process as it evolves. It will take you to the right place. Instead, it's like, well, you got to hurry up and do this or do that, or, well, no.
Get rid of it. Take some medication.
Yeah, take some medication, whatever it is. And it truncates our natural process. You know, I think medication does that for sure. It has the capacity to really put you in a place where you're broken and you have to take medication for the rest of your life, you know. And I think particularly meds for mental health issues just change your ability to be a light-footed evolving human being, you know, where you have to be able to shift. And, you know, I grew up in New York, and walking down the Manhattan, you know, you have to move like this, get around. You have to be a little bit lighter on your feet as a human being to be able to catch the moment internally or externally, to be able to tune in to what is it that really does drive me. Never mind the messages you receive that, oh, you can't make money doing that, or that's not a real career, or it's not appropriate for you as a man or you as a woman, or what, you know, all that stuff that keeps us from being on an authentic path that doesn't have to make sense to anybody else. It doesn't have to make a bit of sense to anyone else. But to have permission that whatever it is you're doing in that process, you are learning something about you. You're learning something about the world at large. And you are going to be a more authentic experience of yourself than if you had listened to all those places along the line that said, no, I think you should give that up.
Yeah. And there's so many voices on that. And there's so many voices that people tune into and tune out of their own. And we don't really refer to process. We're often referring to milestones, as you say, and what are markers of success. And our education system is totally not geared up to responding to the natural evolution of the way that somebody functions, their capacity to learn, their learning style, their natural gifts, you know. So we've got so many of those facets that put humans into ways of functioning that aren't natural for them, and it can take some time. But it's interesting because the other aspect of this that I often find fascinating is that regardless of where you grow up and the environment that you grow up in, you might have, you know, no connection to any of this thing at all, but at some point, you know, you can just be drawn, can't you, to a book, or like you, to a workshop or something, a curiosity. And that was what led me to discovering a lot of the things I did, because I'd experienced a lot of depression in or flatness in my teenage years. And after the birth of my first son, it had it really bad. Just knew there was something different. I didn't want to feel my brain muddled with medication or experience really horrible side effects. I knew there was something else, and sometimes it just takes that trust to search for those different things and notice the experience that you have on that. And some are really profound, because I think when we spoke a few weeks ago that I told you that I had actually gone on a shamanic weekend early on when I was doing my therapy training. I used to try different therapeutic approaches, and I loved the experience because I really connected with it, and it was the journey. But I didn't understand it to the degree that you've just shared with me. I didn't understand the power of sound and how sound was in training those different parts of my brain, and how quickly we were able to meditate, and how beautiful it was to do it with a group of people. And it was interesting because we had a male and female therapists who were shamanic practitioners in this teepee down in the South Coast. And maybe there's a word for this, I don't know, because I haven't been able to ask it before, but they were drumming consistently for ages. And all of a sudden, after a while, I don't know if it was my brain or this was happening, but it was almost like I heard a woman singing, or like a sound in between. Yeah. As we experience this process, I don't know if that's something that usually happens.
Yeah, depending on the drumming, I've heard what sounds like a flute with some people's drumming. Like there's the drum beat, and then I hear this other flute sound. It's like, yeah, where's that coming from? Oh, okay, just a special effect. Cool.
Yeah, your brain notices it for a moment, but also how quickly that meditative experience happened, and it stayed with me for days. And that was the other thing, that with the power of the sound and the multi-layered experience of being in a really beautiful setting and feeling safe as well, because it was therapists doing it, that had the most profound dreams at night. You know, there was a whole load of things also going on in my psyche that I hadn't experienced before, and was just like noticing that. And I've had a few experiences since where I've connected with shamans, with the American Indians a few times, but we'll talk about that on another podcast probably. But what's fascinating about the sound aspects is the research is coming through now about how these sound waves do change our states, do shift neural pathways. And they're even linking some of that to the tones, particular tones that are used, and the influence it has on the middle ear, and how that also stimulates the vagus nervous system and therefore helps process trauma in a non-verbal way, which is often the safer way to help people somatically process trauma. Yeah.
And again, it's coming at the same. What I also love is, you know, science and things like literature and the arts went at one point, and what we didn't realize is they're not straight lines. They're now starting to go back again.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because if you look at the cutting edge physics, if that isn't metaphysics, I don't know what is. Right.
Yeah.
Talking about. Yeah. What underlies all matter is a kind of radiance, not something that we can see with our eyes because it's higher levels of vibration. And that photons, I memorized this because I really don't understand how that works, but I memorized the line. What photons can come together 90 degrees out of phase, some physicist out there knows what that means, and produce an electron. Photons have no mass. The electron that they produce has mass. And it's part of every atom. So light is what is the basis of everything that we think of as solid. And, you know, all the reality that we experience is really underlain by this radiance that continues to make and remake matter, because the electron can pop back out again and disappear. So when you start to see that science itself, probably the most left brain kind of thing, you know, it's grounded like all the STEM kind of things, right? Math and science and technology, that it's becoming metaphysical. There becomes no place where they don't seem to fit together. And it's not about dogma, but it's about this expansive view of who we are in the cosmos. And whether you go through the door of, you know, 160 to 100,000 year old tradition, or you're, you know, a theoretical physicist, we're talking about the same thing. We need to have that much larger view of who we are and what we're capable of doing when we come together. That idea that everything has a quality of being malleable, that we can shift and change things. The physicist I got that 90 degree out of phase thing from, he also says that physicists are now thinking of consciousness as a primary part of physics, not our individual muddly kind of, you know, everyday consciousness, but that expanded sense of consciousness of infinite possibility that we're all capable of achieving. You know, maybe only for a little time, because at some point our body goes, come on back, you need to eat, you need to drink, come on. But during those states, we can have these incredibly transcendent experiences that we feel viscerally connected to nature, for instance, that it's not something that we're looking at, but recognizing that we are a part of it, not intellectually, but in this visceral way, where we suddenly feel completely embraced by it to the point of wanting to weep. Those experiences are something that we need to have as a collective so that we can address what our next steps are as stewards. Yeah. And again, it seems like no accident that these things are all sort of coming together at a time that we need them most desperately.
Yeah, it's for some people, it's quite hard to wrap their heads around anything outside of the senses that we know. But what's like what you rightly say about the science around sound and light is that light, you know, has its different colors, has its own frequency, and there's some colors outside of our visual spectrum that has a particular frequency, and those frequencies are experienced in different ways in our bodies. And that through intention setting, and I think this was displayed in the film What the Bleep Do We Know, which was very similar to The Secret, but The Secret was the one that was advertised and much more well known. But in What the Bleep, you know, it's looking at how intention setting, or the language that we use, influences the water molecules or how it changes the actual vibration, and that you can really change the shape of your reality quite quickly. But the part that I wanted to sort of focus on a little bit was for people who follow actively and are drawn towards the spiritual path, whatever that means to them, whether that is, you know, shamanism or developing their psychic abilities, or the, you know, the, whatever the path is you refer to the human element of this. And sometimes we can be too in our human bodies and not be aware of anything outside of our senses. And some people go into the outer realms and seek those experiences because they can be beautiful experiences, but struggle then to come back into their human experience. And I wondered, and we talked a little bit about this, about in terms of mental health, when things start to go wrong, and whether people have mental health breakdowns, breakthroughs, spiritual emergencies. And I just wondered if the nature of the work that you talked about earlier, that you and your partner have been involved in, is, you know, serious issues that people have faced. So can you go into that a little bit more deeply, of those two sorts of arenas of being human and having these esoteric experiences, but what can happen to the psyche and what you've seen through your work?
What I always share when we're teaching anybody is, you know, they struggle with, well, how do I know this is real? Or, you know, I don't understand how this works. You know, they sort of, what am I actually perceiving? I said, you talked about the limitations of our senses. I said, I love the sensory world, but I can only see the spectrum. I can only see, you know, Roy G. Biv. That's it. Red, orange, yellow, blah, blah, blah. That's all I can see. Raptors can see infrared. They can see the heat trail left behind by the critters that they want. They can see it. Even though that critter is now under the snow, they can see where they've been. Insects can see in ultraviolet. In fact, if you look at ultraviolet images of flowers, they have what looks like a landing pad. It's like, here's where the nectar is. Come get it. Come get it. We can't see it. We just say, oh, they're really pretty flowers, right? But they are designed to signal where their pollen and nectar is for the pollinators. So just because we can't perceive something with our senses does not mean it's not real. And to learn to check inside, does this feel real to me? And what do I do with it when I come back into the physical world? Because that coming back, the other thing I share all the time, if you want expansive experiences, you can only expand as well as you grow roots.
Ah, right.
Like a tree, you have to have a deep root in order to be a very tall tree, or you topple over.
That makes sense.
So you're enjoying your senses when you are experiencing your ordinary life. Do that with a quality of savoring it. My primary teacher in my journey is my great-great-grandmother. She became, you know, chief cook and bottle washer for me. And she says, you think about your life as if you've got a garden trug, you know, those long baskets that people have when they go and get cut flowers. You think about filling that basket. You fill that basket with as much as you can while you're alive. And she says, and don't leave out the bad ones. Put all of it in there, because when you're no longer in a physical body, you will not be able to see or hear or smell or touch or have any of those kind of feelings that are elicited by those experiences, because you will not have a body any longer.
Yeah.
She says, what you will have is the capacity, if you filled that basket well, to pour over those memories and remember. When I hear the word remember as a shamanic practitioner, it is the opposite of being dismembered. We tend to be dismembered from nature as human beings. We are dismembered from people that don't look like us, people that don't worship like us. We've become all these
fragments.
Fragments, thank you. Find the right one. And it is a kind of dismemberment that we also feel inside, particularly the dismemberment from nature. So when she said that to me in a journey, it was like, oh, that's part of us remembering who we actually are. When we pay attention to what's around us and what we are savoring with our senses, even if it happens to be a crappy day, you know, remember what it's like. What did it smell like on that day? When the clouds moved over, what did it feel like when you heard the thunder rumble before you ever saw the storm? Remember that. Remember that with the fullness of your senses as if you were a wild creature. Because it's almost like the act of falling in love. When you take in the person that you've been attracted to with every part of your senses. You know, it's like you fall in love with the idea of them, and then you fall in love with their personality, and then you fall in love with, you know, how they drink their tea and the funny little cockeyed way that they smile, and, you know, all of those things that pull you into such a deep connection can be then used everywhere, where you fall in love with life in such a way that you are not dismembered any longer, and you look for then more ways to connect. And that, to me, I mean, is thrilling in that concept, because it's the exact antidote that we need.
Very much a similar process to what we're talking about in terms of mindfulness and slowing everything right down. But I love the word that you use, which is the savoring. And I remember listening to a lot of the Esther Hicks Law of Attraction videos, and they talk about milking it. And I've said that to a few clients. If you have a really good experience and a good weekend, a good, you know, whatever that is, keep reflecting on that, milk it. And that's what you're talking about, is that savoring moment of slowing it all down and appreciating every tiny morsel of that. It's like when you eat something that tastes really good.
Exactly. And I because my mind tends to be a fast mind, I do that very intentionally when I'm having an experience that I want to keep forever. So, and this will make me weep, so just so you know. My primary power animal is a polar bear. And we were gifted a trip to Churchill, Manitoba in Canada to see the polar bears. And the two of the people that were part of the gathering of the money for us to take this trip came with us as well. And we're out there in the tundra buggies, which are these enormous white trucks, you know, and you're looking out what look like bus windows. And over the course of this, we were there for, I think, 5 days. The only bear that came up to the tundra buggy came up under my window. And that experience, you know, you couldn't leave anything outside. You know, they're hungry. So, you know, I have my fingers right at the edge of the window, and our noses are that far apart because they're really large. Even though this tundra buggy's big, we're nose to nose, really, you know, that far apart. And we're smelling each other's breath. And that, I said, I have to slow down and feel that so that it never goes away. And that experience is what I go to every time I need to reset. And I can smell the air again. I can smell that polar bear. I can see the little white hairs on their dark skin, because they were thin hairs right around their nose. And, you know, the ear tag it was wearing. And I look down, straight down, and their paws have these wonderful sort of sweeps of hair. And the entire paw was like the size of a dinner plate. I have to get a tissue here. and just to be in the presence of that animal. And I'm somebody that's had a lot of wild animal experiences, but that one was just stunning and poignant, knowing that they are even more threatened than we are. So that kind of experience, when you savor, as you say, using the word savor something that's so moving to you, or that is so precious, you know, like when you held your babies, and even if you weren't up to snuff, there's nothing quite like the aroma of a baby. They don't smell like that as they get older. Or how soft something is, or how beautiful the color is when the gardens are all in bloom in May and June. I know you bloom a lot earlier than we do here. And there's just a riot of color. And it's like saturates the air. It's so colorful. When we give ourselves over to those events, it's like saying, okay, I'm in it now. I'm not watching it. I'm in it. Pull myself into it. When we do that, that is also, I think, an expansive experience. Because we're expanding beyond the everyday way we operate, where things go by us, you know, we're walking down the street to work or whatever it might be, and things sort of whiz by. And we're oftentimes in our head, if we're driving or walking, we're in our own head. But when we let ourselves, give ourselves over, really, I think that's the best way to say it, give ourselves over to an experience.
Yeah.
It yes, it's a risk, in the same way that falling in love is a risk. And just about anything can be a risk, I guess. When we give ourselves over to that, particularly something happening in the natural world, we are feeling not just emotionally overwhelmed by it, we're also feeling somewhere in us that connection that we're a part of. And that quality of feeling a part is probably the universal wrench for most mental health issues. The feeling that you are not just visiting, but you are embedded into the beauty. You are embedded into the experience of being nose to nose with a polar bear. You are embedded in the experience of being a first time mother. Whatever it might be, you are in it. It's not like a movie.
And yeah, in the experience rather than being in the head. And often the stuff in, you know, a lot of people, it's all the stuff that goes through the head and that disconnects them. And yet this is about reconnecting. And I loved that you said it's about reset, that when you want to reset, you can reconnect with the same experience over and over again. And we know that the brain can't tell the difference between the reality we're in now and the reality that we're creating in that experience of revisiting that. So you elicit exactly the same chemical processes in the body. Like you say, you know, you connect with the baby, you connect with those experiences that you love. You go into the heart chakra, and that's about expansion. So you will start to expand if you then replicate those. And I talk to clients about layers. You know, you layer the experience, so you layer that one. I have one that I do on a regular basis because I love the island of Ibiza, which is, you know, coast of Spain. And I've been there several times. And I reconnect with it because I love the music that comes from there. And sometimes when I'm driving down the motorway, if the sun's out, like where I live, it's quite boring where I live. But if the sun's out, I imagine that I'm driving the car down the highway in Ibiza with the sea at the side, the sun on my face, the trance music in the car, and I'm back there. Like what you're Absolutely. Saying, I'm back in that experience. And I'm reconnecting. And we can so easily, and you know, and I lose it all the time. I can go back into that other mindset that is winding myself up, or I get frustrated or irritated about something, or, you know, I read something and it, you know, it might create an uneasy feeling. But once you know that you can do that, once you know that you can keep revisiting those good experiences, that's going back to that point about resource, isn't it? You know,
oh,
reset
totally.
A resource.
Totally. I played a game with Roland McCready once. We participated in an experiment of a truly integrative health center that we created with physicians and psychiatrists and nurses, all different practitioners. And we did several conferences, and we had Roland McCready from the Institute of Heart Math. And he was, you know, teaching that whole method about how to come into coherence. And I knew when I was with the polar bear, I was in coherence. I knew. So I thought, I volunteered. Yeah, strap me up, strap me up. And my partner's going, what are you doing? I said, it's just a little test. So he straps me, you know, he puts the heart monitor on me. And he says, wait a minute, we haven't started yet. You've done this before, haven't you? I said, yeah, okay. And it was so, it was really fun to have that second confirmation of what I felt was absolutely true, that those kind of events that we, it's, you know, the geocaching is a popular thing to do now, where people hide some piece of treasure somewhere in the environment. This is like the treasure we hide inside of ourselves. This is this wonderful treat, like being on the island, or me freezing my self with the polar bears. That sense of, this is mine forever. This is my precious.
Yeah.
My precious.
So, precious.
Not in the psycho way, but in the good way. So.
Fine line.
Yeah, it is a fine line. It is a fine line. Oh.
But yeah, and it's that, you know, I remember years ago, realizing well before the research started to show that if with depressed people, and I think I read something somewhere, I don't know how true it is, that it's almost like a criminal offense when you work with depressed people, that you just keep digging up the past, especially the negative aspects. And it's a fine line between people sharing their story and only ever remembering the world in that way, because the depressive experience will actually color the lens that you will look through anyway. And one of the other aspects of this, I'll say to clients, is tracking your experience, because if you're somebody that's experienced depression and more than any other emotion, then even if you have states of joy and happiness and fun and thrilling days, sometimes you can slip back into that mindset and forget that you've had those experiences. So the process of journaling and writing those down and tracking your experience means that you have to sort of almost like physically teach yourself to capture that, to retain it, because it's almost like you can't trust your brain's going to do that unless your therapist helps you do that every few weeks and says, well, I don't know if you have been depressed for 3 weeks, because actually you were telling me that you had a lot of fun last Saturday or something. And then they can reconnect with that, and they start to see either a pattern emerging that there are particular things that can send them into that zone, or there's something else that's coming up for them. You know, they're doing shadow work, or, you know, something's being mirrored back to them that is connecting them with their trauma. And so the brain has a sort of fools us at times to help make us think that we see the world in a particular way. And I had a really odd experience. I had a car accident over 3 years ago, and physically it affected me, but it actually, I had a lot of problem with my eyes, and I got into photography about 8 years ago. So I'm used to looking at the world through the lens of a camera and looking at the detail and the vista and what captivates me, because that's it for me. It's about captivating experiences that light you up. And so I had the car accident, and
I was out and about, and it was really bizarre. So if you've got a TV and you've got the contrast on it, you imagine turning the contrast right up and you've got glaring reds and glaring greens. That's how trees and flowers were looking to me. But it was fascinating. It was disturbing but fascinating, because I was walking around in what looked like a world that had just been coloured in completely differently. And my brain was trying to process, is this what I'm really seeing? And me and the kids were arguing at times, because they said, "Mum, stop changing the TV," because I was changing the colour and everything on the TV. Because I kept saying, there's something wrong with the TV, it all looks strange, and I kept on messing around with it. Anyway, they checked my eyes over at the hospital, and it wasn't my eyes, it was post-traumatic, a shock, because the brain had been banged about so much in the car accident. And it went on, it was really strong at times, and then it started to drift, and then it come back and it would start to drift. But it was really obscure, but it just showed me how, you know, we think we're all looking at the same thing, we think we're all having the same experience, and we think that that experience, we can even make the same meaning of it or derive the same understanding. But actually, it's almost like we can live in our own realities and immerse in that, which is why sometimes it can seem very unreal. And then your reality can do a massive shift, and it's quite difficult to catch up with yourself when it makes that sort of shift. And one of the things I've seen in therapy, in particular in NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, like the shift that you're describing, I've seen clients who have made a radical shift, and you can see the physiology has changed. You can see the coloring changes, the pupils change, but cognitively they haven't realized. And so you have to say, go and experience life for a couple of weeks and then notice what you notice. And then let's talk. And we'll come back and you think, you don't ask them, you know, you're telling me about this story or that story. And you don't ask them because it's no longer there. It doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, getting people, I think particularly who are trapped in the torment that lies between their ears, getting them outside into nature is, I think, critical.
Yeah.
And the wilder, the better, you know, and go to the mountains, wherever they might be, or go to the ocean, go someplace where you feel not only small, but enveloped by nature. Mm. So your problems shrink with you.
Yeah.
You know, when you're out in nature, they just don't have the same hold over you. When you're in the wildness, a storm is being stirred up on the ocean. I mean, that's one of my favorite times to go to the ocean.
It's exhilarating, isn't it?
Oh my gosh, yes. And I remember my father has always had, my late father always had boats, and we'd always be out fishing or doing something on a boat. And he had one tied up, and a hurricane was coming. So he said, you know, being the eldest child, it was like, come with me. You're in charge. Let's go. And we had to loosen the ropes because the tide was, you know, the surge was coming in, and I'm walking through water on the dock that is this steel gray color in a way that I had never seen the ocean. Absolute steel gray, opaquely steel gray, and completely covered in lacy foam. It was the most beautiful experience I had ever seen on the ocean. And I'd been on the ocean innumerable times, you know, it changes color with the sky color and what have you, but this had been stirred up to the point where it was opaque, it was a steel gray, and that this the most beautiful lace of foam over the entire surface. And I just stood there for a while. Of course, he scolded me. It's like, I need you to help with the ropes, which is okay, but to have that experience of see, you know, something that was so familiar was suddenly not familiar.
Yeah.
It's just like you all of a sudden woke up again. And nature always provides those things. You will see an animal you never saw before. You will see a hawk swoop down and get a snack. You know, you'll see on a cold morning, the breath of a deer in a meadow. You know, those kind of things are indescribable on in what they do for us. And not only on a joyful level, but on a such a deep, almost cellular level, our body going, oh, that's right, we're part of that.
And going to the cellular level, and one of the ladies I was doing a podcast with a few weeks ago, Susan Finder, who's done a lot of work on trauma, was saying that, you know, the mitochondria, the cells in the body, it's almost like they get stuck when there's trauma. And sometimes going out into that experience in nature of being completely in awe, exhilarated and mesmerized,
and even a teeny tiny bit of afraid, you know, like for some people, city people, even a little afraid when you're out there, right? That's good for you.
That's expansive. So on a cellular level, there's a whole world of things that are also expanding at the same time, which then when you expand and you know, you can look at levels of consciousness, you know, the diagram that they draw is like a, I can't remember what that shape is actually, but where at the bottom the frequency is like 50 100 150, can't remember the guy who created it, the levels of consciousness, and the further up you go, the more you expand. So, right. And the further down you go, you contract. And so the frequency, the higher the frequency, the love frequency is like 500 and above, you can feel that expansion. And it's playing around with that experience, that experiential, somatic experience in very simple ways, whether it's forest bathing or being on the fishing boat, watching the, I mean, I get mesmerized with, they call it the twilight hour in
absolutely
in photography, the light, how it's cast, and especially some parts of the south coast here, the way the clouds form and the lights cast and the colors are vibrant on the buildings and the waves are crashing, you know, my camera just can't capture this whole vista that I'm stood experiencing, you know, and you want to convey that and you can't sometimes, can you? Right. But yeah, I could go into that whole visceral experience for another few hours. But I wanted you to share with us the work that you're now doing and the courses that you've got coming up that help people on their journey towards them expanding and experiencing more joy, happiness, and a life of fulfillment. So share with us what you've got going on at the moment.
Well, we are in the process of bringing a course to fruition for people who are energetically and spiritually sensitive. And we have lots of stuff going on at the moment, for sure. What I wanted to provide for people is their own, the first step in their key of doing journeying. So that's one of the things I wanted to provide for the audience. Some of you may already be experienced journeyers and you'll have a little six drum audio to listen to with the callback signal. Mm-hmm. And you'll also have a basic primer about journeying and the changes to the brain waves. And Mel will have the address for that. And the quality of your journeys, should you choose to jump in, try it, your quality of your journeys will be progressive. The spirits have no need to change you. If your strong sense is auditory, you may not get images. If your strong sense is that you're kinesthetic or extremely sensitive inside with this strong intuition or knowing, they're not going to mess with that. You'll get your information through your strong sense. And over time, notice what you notice without any expectations, but to simply notice what you notice. Because that process can be magical in and of itself. That you simply notice, oh, now that's a thought I hadn't thought before, or a perspective that I hadn't thought before. And there's something really kind of, oh, it reminds me of when you turn up the heat on a pot of water, a pan of water that you're going to maybe boil eggs in. And the first thing it does is get those little tiny bubbles that hug the side of the pot, right? They don't burst or anything. They're just hugging the side of the pot. Sometimes our process is like that. It doesn't just come on rolling boil. It's all those little bubbles that are just starting to cling to the side of the pot, the bottom of the pot. And then you start to see them. Beep, they pop to the surface. Beep, they pop to the surface. Give yourself, if I have one message for all of you, give yourself permission for your magic and the magic of life to come together in whatever way is right for you. And your head may not know what is right, but if you simply pay attention to the process, you will have remarkable experiences that you can then cache them inside yourself for any time that you need them.
So is this from the link that they get, or is this the course that you...
It's from the link, and the link will get them onto our email list so that they can find out about the course.
Amazing. And the course, what is the course called?
The course is actually called Beyond Ordinary.
Beyond the Ordinary. Amazing. And did you have something else in the pipeline around the sacred feminine?
I'm actually in the process of writing a book from that course that I taught. I went through the doorway of the Norse goddesses, but not just the kind of everyday ones. I went through the ones that are less civilized. Let's put it that way. We need that wild energy of the feminine, that undomesticated, that's even a better word. The old Norse had two words. One was the Innengod and the Utengod, inside the fence, outside the fence. We're too much in defense and we need to be outside the fence and get that energy. So that course will be repeated again, I'm sure. We've done it three times now, and it always is well received. It's a journey of healing, and I want to structure the book in the same way that somebody who might not even have an internet connection can still follow that process.
Are these live courses or recorded, and they do it in their own
they're
time?
Live, and then sometimes we do them again live, but more often, once I've done them live, then they become evergreen courses that we can do again.
Brilliant. And just to touch on this idea of the sacred feminine and the sacred masculine, is language coming through the spiritual community at the moment, and you know, any thoughts around how we support people to move beyond the sort of conditioning, and I think we talked in the past about the toxic relationships or oppression. I think you termed it slightly differently to me.
Well, yeah, we're at least here in the United States, we're in a fit of rabid conservatives trying to put all of the feminine back into the 1950s. And luckily there's a strong group on the other side that is battling with them. But we've, in many states, we've lost the right to abortion. In some places, they're even trying to limit birth control. So we need our wild feminine selves, both in male bodies and in female bodies, and wherever you are in between. We need to call up that energy. In my mind, in my heart, and also in my observations of nature, you don't cross the mama bear. You know, that if you watch deer will actually attack a human being if they feel that their fawns are in jeopardy in some way. Now, you don't think of deer like going after human beings, but they will actually stand on their rear legs and attack somebody with their hooves. Mm. They don't have antlers, right? They're does. They will go after to protect those children. And so that kind of fierceness has not been honored in Eurocolonial culture. You know, we're supposed to be demure, supposed to be quiet.
Gentle
and petite. Lower your voice, dear. Lower your voice, dear. I'm not a lower voice person. So that energy is available for all of us to go, no. And I'm lucky. I grew up with a whole bunch of just wonderfully wild old ladies. My grandparents' generation and their friends, my great grandmother and her friends, and as well as her sisters. And they were loud and they were occasionally vulgar. They told stories. They laughed out loud to the point of tears. And it was so, as the only child, because I was the firstborn, I got to sit there. If I was quiet, I could listen to all the stories and I could be with these wonderful, fierce old ladies. And just it's like they're implanted in my heart.
Wow.
What it means to live fiercely. Yes, you do what it is you have to do. You know, you have to take care of your children when they're young, and you have to do this, that, and the other thing, including my great-great-grandmother having to throw out her husband, who was an alcoholic, and turn the house into a rooming house so she could take care of her seven children. That kind of fierceness is what we need to show up for the earth, show up for those people that need to be lifted up, to show up and go, you can't do that anymore to anyone or any other being. And to do that, we have to heal all those places where we were taught to be small.
Yeah. Now,
fortunately, I am not a rack size. I will never be a rack size. So they couldn't make me small. But that compressed sense of what is appropriate is something that we need to cast off, like, you know, dead skin or something. That's not appropriate. And I feel particularly hopeful that as many people, I'm only one that is working with raising up the feminine, we're also living in a time where young people are going, masculine, feminine? I'll choose, maybe. And so that is exhilarating, because when somebody is presenting as fluid gender or somewhere in there, that they may create an identity that does not yet have a name.
Yeah.
They are uplifting something that is heretical in our culture. Not in indigenous cultures, because there's, you know, there's five genders in many Native American cultures. There's, you know, it's lifting up, like, throw off your chains, people. Move on. Gender is, you know, a tick box on a form. So, you know, that again is also timely to liberate in the best sense of the word, not just take off the chains, but take off the chains up here, about who we are collectively, give also what men need, because patriarchy is an equal opportunity, equal opportunity destroyer, let's say it that way. Because yes, it's obvious that women are oppressed in a patriarchy, but men are taught that they only can feel two things. They can be mad or they can be happy. They're not allowed to be sad. And God forbid they have more than one feeling. Right. God forbid they have more than one feeling at the same time. Like they can't cope, because they were never given permission to feel the full range of feelings.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, you know, there is suffering on both sides. And that's the piece that we have to work on, is if fully empower women and those that identify as women, those that choose to have a feminine aspect as part of their description of gender, that be empowered, because that is involved, you know, in the general sense, in life-giving energy, in protective energy, in restorative energy. If you think the way a healthy mother cares for children, that is the way we need to be with each other and all the other species that we live with on the planet.
It's an interesting phase evolution that we are going through, because when you were talking, it was reminding me of a book that I read, oh, a good 17 years ago. And it was part of this notion of identity that I was grappling with as well, because I did my master's in race, culture and difference, but in particular mixed race, multi-heritage, because they blur the race lines, you see. It's not black and white, it's not this or that. And I found that the language that we were using to describe ourselves, like, really limiting, but I didn't understand the sort of wider spectrum. And I picked up this book, and it talked about the multiple selves, you know, the many aspects. And it was from a point of view of we don't really have this fixed identity. What we have is these different facets, and that these different personas, in a way, have their own resources and limited, that they have their own strengths. And so you can say, you know, Mel the warrior, Mel the yoga teacher that has these qualities, and Mel the teacher, or Mel the therapist, you know. And I remember reading that, and it really did just blow my mind open and turn it into this idea of multifaceted self. And this was well before we were sort of having any of these conversations. And then I read a book by a philosopher, but he's a psychotherapist as well, existential philosopher, Ernesto Spinelli. And he was talking about identity as being fluid. And one of the only things that concerns me is people still will find labels and go, this is what this box looks like. And that's the danger, because a fluid identity just means you can choose. You know, I've had this conversation with my children, because my children are Scottish, Irish, Asian, Mancunian, because we're a multi-heritage family. And I've said, you can choose any of those identities. You know, so even though we've been brought up with certain cultural norms, whatever they are, the food, the dress that we wear, the music that we listen to, the sort of stereotypical aspects of cultural norms, which are useful as a guide, not fixed in stone. But it's about how they can be fluid, support the team that you want to support. 1 week, it can be Italy, it can be Scotland, it can be cricket and eight, you know. And it wasn't a conversation that was easy to have with a lot of my colleagues at the time, but I remember how freeing that was for me. And conversations that I had with, I was meeting writers who were writing about multi-heritage experiences. And I would say, this is how the kids currently identify. Sometimes they identified through race, sometimes they identified through gender. Then we realized that race was a sort of construct anyway, you know. So then it was about identifying beyond that. And are they a footballer? Are they male? Are they, you know, and it's all of these labels. So I think it's great to have that expansion and play around with those different ideas, but there's still a danger of, because our government, and I did explore these sort of American census laws since the sort of early 1900s and the British ones, you know, and that you can have 5 boxes and then you have 10 boxes. And now we're probably, I don't know, we've got variations of maybe 20 boxes, and there's always going to be a box that somebody can't tick. And this is the concern I have, because there's always the capacity in every society to have the majority and the minority. And if there's a majority voice, the minority of whatever that blend is, it happens in every part of the world. So everybody deserves to have a voice. Everybody deserves to be at the table. Everybody deserves to have a say in ground up or politics, policy down. But we're not quite there yet. But the mixing pot has really just... when I look at my Instagram reels, I'm like, yeah, am I even like, wow, how do we have these conversations? Because we haven't had them when it comes to the fluidity of people's race and culture, let alone, we're talking about gender. But we're having the conversations, but of course it's uncomfortable, and it can create a lot of uncomfortableness to people. And how do we, compassion? I think it's acceptance and compassion therapy, or something that teaches people to be able to listen without going into combat, and to listen to the views, and going back to somebody's experience of that, isn't it? You know, of what's my experience of being a woman, you know, where I grew up and how did I identify and how did I get these messages about who I was? Well, they were from the messages that my mum told me about who I was. And that came from the school that I went to, because if you looked this way and you spoke this way and you lived in this sort of family, these are the boxes that you ticked. And so it's down. And sometimes also what I say to people, you've got to go, what was the conditioning? What were the messages you received? What feels like it fits and what didn't really fit? And then we look at that bit, like what you said early when we started talking, of sometimes that's where the energy has been displaced, because we discarded the bits that were unacceptable or that didn't fit or didn't stand up to the what was okay and not okay in the society that you grew up in.
The stuff that fell outside the box.
Exactly. Yeah, the stuff that falls outside the box, yeah.
And, you know, I'm somebody, again, because of the way I was raised, my father ran a service station, petrol station, but he also serviced cars. And it was on a busy bus stop corner. So all the people that would wait for the bus in bad weather, my father gave them permission to stand in the office and wait. There weren't enough chairs for everybody, so they'd wait in the warm office. And so I was the first child, the only child at that time. And I got to be around all different kinds of people in a way that I would not have in other situations. And what I found was everybody had stories.
Yeah.
Everybody had stories, and they had things that they could share that I had never heard of. And it was different stories than the stories my family told. And, you know, there was a wonderful Italian man who had a knife grinding truck. And when he'd come in, he was very effusive, and he was a good friend of the family too. He would ask me to dance the tarantella with him. So the two of us would dance the tarantella, and he'd give me a quarter in the office. And, you know, African-American people, all different kinds of people were present in that place, including some of them were kind of Damon Runyon characters, turdy, turd, and turd kind of accents. And there was one fellow who had a neck deformity. So his head was all shifted over to one side of his body. But he did not consider this to be anything other than just the way he was. And so he had a pet squirrel monkey that he kept on this side. And, you know, when you recognize that there is some kind of treasure in every single human being, whether they know it or not.
Yeah,
and this guy turned this disability, where everyone would go like, "Whoa!" And he had a monkey here, and so people didn't pay attention to the fact his head was cockeyed. They all wanted to talk about the monkey.
That's amazing. But I love that you say that everybody does have treasure within them, and we've forgotten in some circles to share stories, or we've not been a part of that. And it's all of the colors and characters created in those stories that is what enables, on a very basic level, you don't have to go to diversity training. You just need to grow up with a whole different range of people and experience them, and just be open to listening and receiving.
And I also think it's really important to go and hang out with elders once in a while, particularly if you don't even limit it to your own grandparents.
Yeah.
Of course, mine died by the time I was in grade school. Most of mine were gone, except my immediate grandparents. But those really old, funny elders were gone. So I adopted one. In fact, I adopted two. I adopted the oldest woman in my town, and I would take a different bus home so that I could stop at her house. And I'd sit, we'd have a cup of tea. She'd pull out the same, I think it was the same tin of cookies. She'd offer me one. And I'd just let her talk. She lived alone. Oh. She was in her 90s, and she told marvelous stories about when she was young, and, you know, and I'd ask her questions, and it was, you could see her mood lift. I had a wonderful time just sitting with her, and then I'd catch another bus and wind up home. And there was the woman who lived behind us who they built, what do you call it? We call them developments, but you have a housing something where they build all the little houses, housing estate.
Yeah, estate, yeah.
I've watched enough BritBox. I can do this. they built this whole development around her little summer cottage that she wound up living in full time. She was the same age as my grandmother, so we adopted her. She became Grandma Edie. Her name was Edith. Yeah. And we brought her into the family, and she was there for all the holidays and all the birthdays. And she was somebody who was an interesting woman who had become a nurse. She was very Catholic, went to church every day, but was not narrow-minded. At the least, she was curious. That just was a delightful experience to be with somebody who could talk about, you know, things that I didn't experience except in history books, but also be open-minded to find out what I was doing when I went to art school, you know, talk about art school. And she says, oh, that's it. You know, you'd have a wonderful conversation. And I think intergenerational conversations with the very young, the very old, are essential to us putting our own lives into context.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I could listen to your stories all night. I've so enjoyed our conversation.
Oh, I have as well.
That's taken us everywhere. And before we end, I'd like to say thank you to you and to our ancestors that brought us together, and for all the support that we get from the people that we can see and the people that we can't see that helps us on our journey. And I do hope people follow up the link and find out more about your work, because I can tell that there's a lot of incredible shifts and experiences that people have had and will have by working with you.
Thank you, Mel. This was lovely. So it must be quite late where you are now. So
yeah, it's not too bad, actually. We're just coming up to 9, so that's sort of early for me, but it is going dark. Hence why anyone who sees my podcast, the light is different than every podcast, because I tend to sit in a cave. I'm quite light sensitive, you see, so I've got to watch. I'm like a bear in a cave.
Whatever works.
Exactly. But I look forward to chatting with you further on another occasion.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's make it a regular feature.
Definitely. Is there anything else you want to share that I haven't asked you, or anything else that you've got going on that you want us to know about before we finish today?
No, just enjoy the little guide and the audio, and we'll get your email address so that you can find out about the course, and we can have fun together. I'm brilliant. All about having fun together, even when it's hard. Definitely. It can be fun too.
Yeah, well, fun, actually. Yeah, fun and laughter is very, the healing effect of that is amazing too. So, well, I'm gonna finish for tonight, and I could carry on listening to your stories. They're lovely, and I think you're right, it's the storytelling that really makes a difference to people's day and lives. But bye bye for now.
Take care. You bye bye.
Bye bye.